are being made available, but that there'll be no quick fix.
These things are going to take time. I don't want to make any false promises to people. We'll do everything we can. The resources are there. The money is there. The councils will get the money from central government. The military are on standby to help where they can. We'll go as fast as we can. But tragically, these things will take some time to get right.
Meanwhile, First Great Western's announced its rail fares for anyone affected by the collapse of railway line in Devon will drop 25% from Monday. Well, David Cameron has also been fending off criticism over a speech he's given ahead of the Scottish independence referendum. He's claimed the whole of the UK would lose out from a split, but the SNP's described him as cowardly for making that speech in London rather than Scotland itself. Another strike date's been announced by a union representing teachers in England and Wales. NUT members will walk out on March the 26th, unhappy at changes to make their pay performance-related. The Winter Olympics opening ceremony's begun in the last hour. The Sochi Games will cost around £30 billion, more than three times as much as London 2012. Our reporter Katie Stallard, who's there, says the build-up's been hit by security threats and concerns about Russia's anti-gay propaganda law.
The Great British team have just marched into the stadium waving their union flags, and close behind them, the athletes from Germany, whose outfit appears to be the rainbow flag. They are clearly proud to be here, but there will certainly be a lot of speculation about the message that they are trying to send.
In sports, West Ham have failed in their bid to overturn Andy Carroll's three-match suspension. An FA tribunal's decided the red card he picked up in their Premier League match against Swansea last weekend shouldn't be rescinded. And ITV has confirmed Simon Cowell will return as a judge on the next series of The X Factor. He's missed the last three to work on the American version of The Talent Show. That's the latest. I'm Tom Howergan.
BCFM 93.2.
Yes, it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Deputy Leader of Bristol City Council's Conservative Group and Councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, a US State Department official, Victoria Nuland, shoots her mouth off and shoots to fame after being as disparaging as it's possible to be about the European Union in a bugged phone call. It happened during a leaked phone conversation with her ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt. She was explaining who she wanted to be the next Prime Minister of Ukraine, where she revealed the new Prime Minister would be endorsed by Joe Biden in the United States and the United Nations, with no say whatsoever by the Ukrainian people. Also, the first really comprehensive interview since June last year, when he blew the whistle with former CIA operative, private contractor and NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. It's done by German television, but still not aired here in the UK. Here he explains just how powerful private interests have become here in Britain and the United States, effectively privatising our secret services behind the backs of Parliament, press and public alike. Plus, February is frack-free in Somerset for campaigners across the county, and Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the global flashpoints and hopefully too some further financial markets. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows 5 Celsius and some heavy showers. This weekend, highs of 7 Celsius, sunshine and showers this weekend, and also windy. Next week, highs of 7 Celsius, some sunshine, heavy showers and windy at times. Next weekend, that's the 15th and 16th of February, highs of 5 Celsius, fairly sunny but feeling colder. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Deputy Leader of Bristol City Council's Conservative Group and Councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston. Hi, Mark, welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening, thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, one of the committees you're on is called the Sustainable Development and Transport Scrutiny Commission. In fact, am I right to say you chair it?
I do, yes.
Yeah, tell us what that involves.
Well, transport, shockingly. So, for example, we've been looking at things like how the city's bus service works or doesn't work, things like the residence parking zones, We've looked at things like rail, air quality, and then we also look at sustainable development. So we're looking at employment skills, say the South Gloucestershire development happening in, around Cribbs Causeway, Filton Airfield. We'll be looking at those kind of things in the round.
What about you know, you're talking about the transport there. Buses is always a big issue. We were hearing last week that actually there are some positive signs from the buses, from Gary Hopkins from Lib Dems, saying that actually there's quite a big increase in bus use. Is that something you're detecting too?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's what we've been arguing for a while, is actually if you reduce fares, people will use it.
But isn't it also just simply because there's less money around? People have got less money in their pocket that they can't afford all of the overheads that come to owning, running, buying petrol and running a car?
I'm not sure on that one. I've heard that one used a lot. And, you see, I think the problem is you can't use a bus for everything, or people won't use a bus for everything. So it's hard to bus for the school run if you particularly got numerous sites, the weekly shop, things like that. So invariably people need or have a car for those kind of activities. What I think we're seeing at the moment is people having a car but just leaving it and using the bus during the week as well. So people still have the car, but they're just choosing to use the bus more often. Is more how I would see it.
Okay, what about on the railways as well? What are your thoughts about the big national plans, the high-speed rail? Because for a lot of people, they're looking at that as this is a sort of a choice, very expensive project, far away. It's not going to be much help to people here in Bristol, is it?
No, I mean, to be honest, I'm not a fan of HS2, and I would get rid of it tomorrow. I don't see. I think if we're going to prioritise rail investment, what's the most important thing we want? Is it to get the employee to his place of work, or is it to get the executive down from up north to London? Now, I'm sorry, for me, we need to totally reorganise the way our suburban and urban railways work so that people can move around our congested cities more easily than we do need to necessarily fire a train as fast as possible between major cities. So I would scrap HS2, and actually I would then devolve that funding down to the sub-regional level for additional investment in places like Bristol.
You're sounding very much like the Greens, because they've just released yesterday a statement on they're saying they want resilient regional railways, not vanity projects, in the wake of the collapse of the Exeter Penzance railway line. Rupert Reid, Green Party National Transport Speaker, said we've got long opposed HS2 as an overblown vanity project and favoured transferring about $10 billion from its price tag towards improving local rail routes.
$10 billion. They're still going to leave in for $38 billion or whatever it is in there. No, I mean, let's face it, the Greens and I are going to agree on something now and again. It might be rare, but in this one we do. The thing is, for me, it's such a large price tag. Now, I think the maximum limit they put there was $50 billion on it. I would much rather that we split that in half. Half of it was then devolved so we can actually build more houses, because we do need them. We particularly need some more social housing. And then the other half should go into urban rail. And I would much rather see that. And I think that will be a bigger boon to our economy than being able to get between Liverpool and London 20 minutes faster.
Okay. What about residents parking, though? Let's get a bit of an update on that, because everybody's concerned about that. Why it's certain areas of the city which have no problem with residents parking are being foisted, this scheme is being foisted on them. There's a lot of unhappiness about the way it's been done, and that's almost bound to happen, whoever does it and however they do it.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, say this. This isn't my decision. On a personal level, and this is my personal level, I don't like residence parking zones. I just don't. I think, for example, if you're in somewhere like Clifton, where I used to live when I was a wee bit younger, I liked the lifestyle there. So I liked the bars, the restaurants, the shops. But the problem is, I think if you bring in residence parking zones, that then it becomes a threat to those businesses and actually could undermine the businesses which provide the lifestyle that you actually like, and not to mention the additional cost. But some people do want them and they do like them. So my philosophy has always been, if you're going to enforce this or, you know, put it onto people, then they should have a consultation which they can say no to, so they have the ability to reject it if they want. Let local people decide. Everyone keeps talking about localism, but they kind of do it in a way that actually doesn't devolve power to them. Let the people decide what's best for their own community. Now, as it is at the moment, it looks like, I think it's Cottam North and the Clifton Wood schemes are due to start in the next couple of weeks. So the consultation on those has happened. And what we're calling the inner ring, or inner core, which is sort of all of Clifton, Redland, or a chunk of Redland, Cottam, and spreading out around that area, that is all coming in the next few months. The mayor did put on hold the the outer ring, which are, you know, heading up into Horfield, Bishopston, and all that area. So he has put on hold that. We'll wait to see whether that comes back.
Okay. What about congestion charging? Because this is one of the things that's also being talked about. This is being done. No, just a straight no.
Absolutely detest congestion charging.
You're not up for residence parking, but it's being foisted on us. I mean, the same is possibly likely to happen with George. With congestion charging.
Look at residence parking zones. Okay, residence parking zones apparently are brought in to tackle an issue around commuters coming in parking residential roads. I get the aim on that. Congestion charging, I think, is actually simply a tax that stops those of us that have to drive from moving around the city in our cars. I'm utterly against congestion charging. And whenever you put it out to the public, they're against it too.
Okay. Old Lady Broxford economist Martin Summers, let's bring you in here. Because a lot of people are looking at these various charges, the potential in the future to put a charge on every car that comes into the city centre. But certainly right now, these new resident parking zones are being imposed on the city, as Mark was saying, in the next few weeks. What are your thoughts about this way of doing things? A lot of people are very upset about another tax, particularly in the inner city.
I think if people have residence parking zones, and if you are a resident, you get a free... You get a free visa. This is the problem, isn't it?
It's not what's happening.
Well, exactly, and that's what people are upset about, and quite rightly so. I mean, I think there is a fairly clear split between rather wealthier communities who feel that that's what they like, and certainly there's a lot of resistance on the ground in the inner city from people who don't want to pay to park their cars outside their houses, and they just don't want to do it. But if they were told that you could do it, you will get a free place but to park your car, and
we've moved quite a way away from there, Mark, haven't we?
I'm actually not quite sure of the argument. There's quite a lot of hostility to residence parking zones, regardless of your social demographic or eco-demographic. So just trying to say that the wealthy are in favour and those that have less are against, I just... No, that sounds a little too simple. People, I suppose, well, George has decided, rather, that people want residence parking zones, so therefore he's going to bring them into the centre of the city. The council was, you know, pretty adamant last summer that actually if you're going to do that, then there should be a right of refusal. He's not gone with that. Actually, my transport, the Sustainable Development Transport Scrutiny Committee, has actually had a working group part of it, which is looking at recommendations on how to improve the residence parking zones. And actually, one of the things we did look at is cost, because actually the inner ring, it's quite a large capital cost, but its costing is modelled on the outer ring coming forward with it. And it's all quite kind of complicated, but essentially the inner ring would subsidise the outer ring. So the price at £48 for the inner ring reflected less income in the outer ring. So we actually think if you're only going to proceed with the inner ring, then actually the mayor should look at the cost again, because we think those permits could be cheaper.
And is that likely to happen?
It's entirely in the hands of George.
Now, this is the point, isn't it? Is it a dictatorship at the moment here in Bristol? Does George really make all the decisions? And all you can do is just crisscross your fingers and hope that he listens to you, Mark?
No, I mean, it's not quite. I mean, there's soft power and there's hard power on this. First of all, you can't really describe George, as much as I disagree with him on several issues, we agree on a few, but as much as I disagree with him, you can't call him a dictator because you can just throw him out. You know, I suppose he's the old Greek term tyrant, but they did elect them and they could get rid of them. So he's not a dictator, but people did vote for him. And they did that fairly convincingly. He has full executive power. The council has to set the budget. And he needs a cabinet made up of the councillors in order to function. But that
cabinet doesn't really seem to do much. The people in the cabinet say, and their colleagues say, they haven't really got any power.
Well, again, it's soft and hard power. I mean, George, I don't think yet, has gone to the wall over an issue where every single member in his cabinet disagrees with him. But it is the presidential model. You know, was that quote, was it Abraham Lincoln when he was talking to his cabinet? And his cabinet, right, all those against, and all of his cabinet put up their hands, all those in favour, and only he did, went, right, the ayes have it. So it is that model. It is a presidential model. But it's, the people voted for that model in a referendum, and they then voted for George in an election. Ultimately, you got what you voted for. I didn't vote for him.
Do you think the individual parties are getting value for money from their representatives on the cabinet?
Yeah, I do. I do, to an extent. I mean,
maybe you can really only speak for your own party,
I can only speak for mine. I mean, from our point of view, for example, if you look at the council's budget and what that whole process is money's tight. So George brought forward this whole raft of proposals and various cuts and efficiencies and all the rest of it, and we went and said, look, if you want to get some of this through, then we want this, the X, you know, X, Y, Z, and all the rest of it. So we did manage to secure things. Like, we stopped his idea of closing museums. We got additional money for rail station improvements. The, you know, stopped public toilet closures. So we can work with him on numerous issues, but we don't agree with him on everything. Now, that's just life.
Okay. Old Day Broxford economist Martin Summers, do you think that this is also the way that, you know, the city can function effectively like this, with George really making all the final decisions, whereas the individual political parties seem to have been rather sidelined? And actually, voting, as we're going to be doing in May for local councillors, seems to be less valued with a mayor.
Well, I mean, my views were clear. I didn't want a mayor. I campaigned against having a mayor.
It was actually quite a narrow margin.
The point is that it's all based on very, very small. It's less than a third of the population participated in any of this, so people can get carried away with what the mandate actually represents. But I think what's interesting, what's happening in Bristol, is an attempt to try and do things a bit differently. I was not even that keen for the Labour Party to join his cabinet, to be honest with you, but others saw it differently, and I think a lot of people on the doorsteps were saying to us, well, we'd like you to go in and have a go, because we don't want you to just, you know, oppose. But of course, when we come to elections and so on, we've now got a one-party state, if you like. We're all implicated in what's going on. Now, there's some quite interesting aspects to that. I think Bristol's probably the only place in the country where you could get all the parties to sit around and actually try and come up with a shared vision, and I'm quite attracted to that idea. But then, of course, the problem is if there is a massive cock up, who are the people going to vote for then? Because everybody's implicated in what's going on. For example, I shall be demonstrating against the cuts tomorrow, against people in my own party who are in a cabinet which is putting those cuts through. And that's the contradiction that we're in.
Okay, on to one.
Can I come back on that?
Yeah, go on.
Just for a second. The thing is, when you have referendums, I mean, look at like the devolved authorities. I mean, by that, look at Wales. Now, when it came to voting for devolution in the 90s, under half the population of Wales voted in the referendum, and the margin was 50.1% to 49.9%. But ultimately, elections are won by those that take part. Now, everyone is entitled to vote. Everyone is given that option to vote. But equally, they have that option not to vote. So I'm afraid I go from the old, you know, school that says you can't complain unless you've tried to do something different. And if you haven't voted, I don't have a great deal of sympathy.
Okay, on to our next story. Plans to privatise police custody services for Bristol have been dropped, according to the Bristol Post. Plans to outsource management of police cells in the Bristol area to a private company have been dropped. Avon and Somerset Police and Crime Commissioner Sue Mount Stevens opted to continue with the current system of running custody services using police's own staff after finding it would cost more to bring in an outside firm to do it. A police statement announcing the decision said it had been made after an extensive review of the business case for each option. It found that bringing in a private company to do the job currently done by the police officers and civilian workers would cost taxpayers £600,000 more over a 4-year period, Mark.
Got no comment on that. I'm quite happy.
Well, I mean, this is government. Okay, this is Westminster policy.
Yeah, no,
what they're saying, even in Somerset, is no, we're not having it.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think Sue Mann Stevens was right to look at any option out there, any way that they can try and save money, as long as they can secure public safety and they can get a quality service, is a good thing. Personally, I'm delighted that the police are going to carry on running that service.
What about having these new big custody suites outside the city? Are we talking about one at Patchway, one in Canesham, and I think one down in, is it Yeovil or somewhere down in South? These are where people will be kept, not in the city. So if someone's released, then they've got maybe half a day's walk to get back home.
I genuinely don't have an opinion on that. I wasn't even... I'm not going to lie, I don't know.
Okay, Martin, I mean, these are these three. I mean, we actually had Kevin Phillips from the Police Federation on here a couple of weeks ago talking about these three new super custody centres. So it just sounds a little bit unfair, doesn't it, to release somebody, you know, what is possibly maybe the best part of a day's walk away from home. Not actually in the cities. Trinity Road Police Station and the custody suite there, apparently, this is according to Kevin, the rumour is it's already been sold.
Well, I mean, I tend to agree with Kevin about most of these things. I mean, I don't believe in privatisation in general, and I certainly don't believe in it in relation to things like public order. I mean, ultimately, when you're taking people's liberty away, everybody's got to recognise that this is not being done for somebody's private profit, and that's one of the things that's very important about the functions of the state, that it is above to making private profit out of things like that.
I mean, Mark, do you have any problem in principle with outsourcing things like custody, looking after prisoners in police cells to a private business?
Well, actually, I kind of do. I think there are ways that you can make efficiencies in the back office. But as far as I see it, you know, when it comes to front of house, handling prisoners is front of house. And I think that needs to remain within the parameters of law enforcement and within the hands of the police.
Okay.
So I would prefer to stay there.
Staying with the police, another story, a national one this time. Police will have a backdoor access to health records despite the opt-out, says an MP. David Davis says police will be able to approach Central National Health Service database without a warrant, as critics warn of a catastrophic breach of trust. This is Randeep Ramesh, Social Affairs Editor at The Guardian, yesterday. The database will store the entire the entire nation's health records has a series of back doors that will allow police and government bodies to access people's medical data. David Davis MP, former Shadow Home Secretary, told The Guardian he's established that police will be able to access the health records of patients when investigating serious crimes, even if they'd opted out of the new database, which will hold the entire population's medical data in a single repository for the first time in history. From May, Martin.
Well, I think David Davis is probably concerned about the civil liberties implications of this. And, you know, we have got a Data Protection Act and so on, and we're increasingly moving towards a situation where people are under constant surveillance. And, of course, the real bother with this is that insurance companies could get access to it, and then, of course, they won't insure certain people once they know what their conditions are.
But it's not just that, is it? I mean, any corporation can be sold this information. Yeah. And here what we have is information which between a doctor and a patient is private, totally private, and supposed to be entirely confidential here. They're saying, well, any police officer, without going to a judge to give a reason, basically has got a little password. They type a password in and they've got access to your medical records.
Two things. First of all, coming back on what you were saying, insurers won't insure people. Insurance is hedging. So actually, insurers, if they're talking about like health insurance, they need to know your health records. And I'm not quite sure your argument on there. No. You do need to probably state what they are. And if you lie on it, then your insurance is void. Yeah. But coming back to the police side of it, the issue for me comes down to serious crimes. What is the serious crime threshold? Because if we're talking about some horrific murders, if we're talking about rapes, then actually, I want to catch that criminal. I do not want them walking the streets. So I think so long as there is proper judicial oversight, which it sounds like there isn't, and I think there needs to be changed so it is, then I think the police should be able to access medical records in the pursuit of serious crimes. But I would like to see two things. One is what the threshold of serious crime actually is, and I want to know the detail. And the second thing is I do still think they need to go before a judge before they can access that data.
We'll just remind listeners of there is a website out there. It's called optout.care-data.info. That's optout.care-data.info. Online, where you can print out a form which you can send to your doctor to opt out of this the sale of the national database of private records. But the ultimate point here, Mark, surely, is that this, as David Davis has actually said in this article, that it totally undermines a long-held belief in the confidentiality of the doctor-patient relationship. Doctors may not be upfront with their patients if they feel that this information is going to be put on a national database and accessed by other people, and the same exact thing with the patient.
Yeah, but also what the actual report saying is that if it's being sold, which is what you're saying, then the personal information is then redacted from it. So it won't actually say
The argument is, I mean, this is why people are worried about it, is that there's enough information there, quite enough for people to actually identify who it is that they're talking about. That was the discussion last week when this story first hit the
David Davis headlines. Gives is, you know, as he says, I've had my nose broken 5 times. Once you know that, I'm probably in a group of 100 people. When you figure out that I had my diphtheria jab, usually done at birth, and bang, you got me. Now, not being funny, in order to know that, I would have to have his medical record in order to know who it was in his medical record. You actually need all the information to know that the medical record is his. So you already have his medical record to do it. I'm not quite sure what he he's going at on that point.
So are you, would you be opting out from this system, or are you happy to have all your private medical records go into this database for sale?
Well, the thing is, you keep going on to sale, and that I understand why, because it will be sold, but what will it be sold to? It'll be sold to,
anybody, absolutely anybody that wants information about specific areas, which might include you.
Well, it might be, and I don't have a, I personally don't have a problem. I understand why people.
Martin, what about
you? What I would say, hold on, before it goes, I say, if for access from the police, you need to have the serious crime threshold, you need to go for a judge. And I personally don't think it should be sold for anything that's not actually medically linked.
Well, what they're saying here, and what David Davis and Randeep Ramesh in The Guardian are saying, is that there will be just a simple password. You won't have to go and talk to a judge at all.
I think they're wrong there. I do. But I think if there is a genuine medical reason why you might need a population overview, and that you could see why there might be, then I think I don't have a problem with that data going out.
It's interesting in a way, isn't it? Because we've had all this stuff about Edward Snowden and the passwords and various passwords being sniffed by the NSA and GCHQ anyway. One wonders why this is needed to have some sort of central database which is all in one place, because surely those passwords can be sniffed by the NSA, GCHQ anyway. Martin, what's your thoughts about whether you're going to be opting out from this or not?
I probably won't get round to bothering to opt out, but at the same time, I think I agree that we, you know, I can't see why would you sell this to anybody? The government's got a legitimate reason to know health statistics.
Well, it's raising money. The government is raising money, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's in control of a resource. Let me just say this, right? It's in charge of a resource, which is our private medical records, and it's seen an opportunity to sell them.
Well, I'm just saying that's wrong. Basically, yes, okay, the government needs to have statistics to make plans about how many hospitals we need or whatever, but there's no reason to give that to anybody, and certainly not to sell it for profit. That's absurd.
Okay, final reminder of the opt-out form if you're interested in that. It's optout.care-data.info. And the unions this week have been hitting back at the Labour Party voting reforms. Senior union activists, we hear in The Independent from Mark Leftley, that's last Sunday, fear that Labour's reforms to the way that the party leader is selected will result in centrist, white, middle-aged, grey suit candidates in the future. Ed Miliband announced at the weekend that he will move the party to a one-member, one-vote system. Now, Martin, this is your party. What are your thoughts about having one member, one vote, rather than getting rid of, effectively, the union's block vote? That's the biggest change.
Yes, obviously this is causing a great deal of anguish on various sides of the party. I mean, I'm personally not particularly in favour of the unions funding the Labour Party. In the rest of Northern Europe, for example, the DGB in Germany does not fund the SPD. The SPD, and it happens in Nordic countries as well, you've got state-funded political parties. And the unions, of course, have their funds, and in Germany they keep their funds for strikes. They don't give them to anybody.
Okay, Mark?
I actually think this is going to hand power to the unions, to be honest. I mean, I understand the concern on it, but what they're proposing to do is go to one member, one vote. So, whereas before the MPs had a third, the Labour Party membership had a third, and the unions had a third, now if you pay the membership fee, you have a vote, but they'll also give a vote to anyone that pays £3 as an associate member. Now, you might be able to help me out on this, Martin, but I understand that £3 is the same as the political levy that unions charge. Yeah. Is that about right?
Yeah.
So you see, I'm slightly concerned, and this hasn't happened yet, and I don't know how it'll work, but if you have a union with 1 million members, can you get all of them to sign up as associate member for £3? And then at that point, you've got your 200,000 party members, and you've suddenly got 1 million trade unionists. So rather than have a third of the vote, they now have 80% of the vote. I think that's the problem.
Well, no,
I know there is a form. This is just my fear. And I know that may not happen. I'm assuming the unions would have signed it up. But there is the possibility there that exists that could happen.
Well, I think this is quite interesting, because ultimately what you're going to have is that MPs will lose, you know, because their votes are worth an aught, because the third of the electoral college is MPs.
Yeah, which is wrong.
Yeah, but I mean, in other words, he's moving to a one-member, one-vote setup. Yeah. But, of course, we're going to have two sorts of membership, the full membership, like mine, and this associate membership for trade unionists. And, of course, they've got to opt into that rather than opt out.
Which is a good thing. That is a good change.
So in other words, we're then going to have probably a smaller number of voters than we've had in the last election.
Yeah.
But it will all be in one ballot, if you see what I mean. Everybody will get everybody will vote in the one ballot, including individual union members. Don't forget, it wasn't the unions are not can't use block votes here. Their members will get a vote, and if they choose to be part of it. Many unions have already disaffiliated from the Labour Party, and they won't get votes.
But we know, I mean, we saw in the last Labour leadership, for example, where was it? They had Ed Balls on the outside of the ballot envelope.
The unions themselves say that we are allowed to recommend to our members who we think they should vote for, but they can choose not to if they want to.
That a bit distasteful. You put the candidate on the outside of the ballot paper. But be that as it is.
Martin,
hand power to the unions.
Martin, how is this going to change the political colour of Labour?
Well, I think it's interesting because what it implies is that the unions are going to have to get out there and mobilise their members to participate in these elections.
Well, that's no bad thing, is it? Anyway.
And it may lead to a situation where individual union members will have more power. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Let's just also, because whilst we're on the subject of unions, a big tube strike, 2 days in London this week. We're just hearing today in The Guardian from Gwyn Topham that Boris Johnson's officials are in a threat to sue the union using European law. Eurosceptic London mayor sanctioned threat to sue union for revenue loss, citing European Convention on Human Rights. Well, what are your thoughts about the rights and wrongs of this strike? I know it's a long way away, 100 miles or so in London, but it's affected
the... I've not followed it in a massive way.
It's affected the capital massively. 2 days of very few tube trains.
Oh, it's absolutely gridlocked it.
What about the ticket office issue, though? Because this is what it's all about, isn't it, really? Ticket offices closing.
Well, I have to say, I can understand the merit of that on the tube, because virtually everything is automated, or Oyster carded and all the rest of it. So I certainly think there's an argument to close them, and I don't think that the union should have struck on this issue. I think strikes ultimately are the sanction for it. But I have to say, I think the RMT is being a little militant on this one.
Yeah, but I mean, 950 of their members are going to lose their livelihoods.
Ultimately, the reorganisation on this is those livelihoods and the jobs, sadly, that go with them aren't needed for the modern underground.
Martin, is this just a question of modernisation, as Mark's saying? Well, there? They're going to have to like it or lump it.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that Boris Johnson actually promised that he wouldn't close ticket offices as part of his pitch to the London electorate. And that's what Bob Crowe's saying. You said you weren't going to do this. That's a bit like no top-down reorganisation of the NHS, isn't it?
Quite.
Also, I mean, aren't we becoming a little bit too reliant on this technology? What when the technology doesn't work? You're going to end up with tube stations full of people all banging their fists saying, you know, let me through the barriers when things don't go correctly, aren't they?
Well, quite possibly, but I suppose that's the modern world we live in. We become increasingly technology reliant.
But I mean, the tube trains themselves apparently are also being designed to slowly but surely over the years get rid of the drivers. I mean, we're going to go down a tube where there's actually nobody around at all from the London Underground staff?
Now, hang on a minute. I don't think at all that you can take the driver out of the train, because I think you always need a human brain there as the fail-safe, the ultimate fail-safe that can pull the lever or whatever. Closing a ticket office isn't life or death, but I think having a train driver there, you need them there. Even if it's an emergency brake, they're totally different issues.
Martin, do you think Bob Crowe's a Luddite?
No, I think...
Ask me that question.
I think it's a question... this is actually a struggle for public opinion, isn't it? Let's face it. And they did opinion polls in London, and they showed that the vast majority of commuters actually supported the goals of the strike. They didn't want to...
They asked a loaded question.
Well, indeed, but at the same time, the point is, as I said earlier, Boris Johnson did promise that he wasn't going to do this, and now he's doing it.
The question, I think, if I get the wording right, was... do you believe that industrial action should be the final sanction in industrial relations? So it was quite. It wasn't to do specifically with the strike. It was a general loaded question, and they got the result they wanted.
And what about talk that this might be made against the law, this kind of strike? It's an essential service, transport. They're not allowed to strike.
I'm not buying that one, to be honest. I may not like the strike, but the union's ultimate sanction is they do have the ability to strike. I personally would change strike laws so that you need a majority of members to agree to a strike. At the moment, it's simply a majority of those that take part. But that contradicts what I said earlier when I said elections are made by those that take part.
What about a majority of constituents to elect a Conservative MP?
I think at that point we would probably have about 12 MPs across the entire country.
Interestingly enough, the NUM rule book always officially said that you've got a 50% plus one of the members voting for a strike. Which, of course, yes. And the reason for that, of course, is quite straightforward. You can't have a successful strike unless you've got at least half the members to agree.
This is the mine workers who...
This is the NUM rule book.
Yeah.
And of course, that was there for a purpose. You've got a 55% of all those participating. And of course, it's not good that people are going out on strike without having been balloted properly.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that Bob Crowe would recognise that. You know, if people don't participate in the ballot, it does undermine the strength of what you're trying to do.
I mean, ultimately, I think it comes down to, you know, the London Underground and Transport for London. Their job is to provide a service. It's not to employ the most number of people. And sadly, I think that technology is moving on and the ticket offices probably aren't needed.
OK, now back to, or over to Westminster now, and a couple of clips from Ed Miliband and David Cameron. And this was a couple of exchanges over women MPs.
Look at the all-male front bench raised before us. And he says he wants to represent the whole country. Mr. Speaker, I guess they didn't let women into the Bullingdon Club either. So there we go. Now, he said a third of his ministers would be women. He's nowhere near meeting the target. Half of the women he appointed as ministers after the election have resigned or been sacked. And in his cabinet, get this, Mr. Speaker, in his cabinet, there are as many men who went to Eton or Westminster as there are women. That is the picture. Does he think it's his fault that the Conservative Party has a problem with women?
He's interested in the figures. Let me give him the figures. Of the full members of the Cabinet who are Conservatives, 24%, a quarter of them are women. Not enough. I want to see that grow. Of the front bench ministers of the Conservatives, around 20% are women. That is below what I want to achieve in 33%. We are making progress and we'll make more progress. But let me make this point. This party is proud of the fact that we had a woman Prime Minister. Yes. Yes. No. To be fair.
Order. Mr. Gove. Very overexcitable individual. You need to write out 1,000 times. I will behave myself at Prime Minister's questions. The Prime Minister.
That was the Speaker there ticking off the Education Secretary Michael Gove, asking him to do write out 1,000. No, was it 1,000 or 100 times that he must behave himself at Prime Minister's questions, which is quite entertaining. But on the serious subject there, the Conservative Party in Westminster does have a problem, doesn't it, with women? It just seems that there's not enough. Certainly their aim is to get at least a third in these front bench and ministerial positions. They're nowhere near that.
No, they're not. I mean, I think... I don't like any form of positive discrimination or any kind of quota that goes on it. I think we need more women in politics. I mean, the Conservatives, I think there's 305 MPs, and I think it's only about 50 are women. So the proportion in the cabinet for 33% would be, if you would, overrepresentative of the thing, of the numbers. I think we just have to look at actually trying to get more women, encourage them into politics. But what I don't like is when you go to things like women-only shortlists. And I have a lot of friends, female friends, that say the same thing. They'd rather get ahead on merit rather than actually because they ticked a quota box.
But I mean, the point here is, I mean, he's making there is that half of the women ministers have resigned. I mean, it does give you an air that the cabinet and the ministers, that circle is really not women-friendly if half of them have resigned already.
Well, I don't know. I'm not in the cabinet. I think there was an article from Charlotte Leslie on this the other day. Politics isn't for everyone at all. It is cut and thrust. It's bloody. It's getting the angry tweets, Facebook messages, emails, and that isn't for everybody. And if you don't like it, people do quit. And men have quit. Women have quit. The thing that surprised me when all this really kicked off, and I think when Miliband went to war, was over the deselection of Conservative MP Anne McIntosh. by her own party, and he tried to say that the party was against women. But of course, the very next day, the party then deselected Tim Yeo. So I suppose you could say we're even in that regard.
Okay, well, before we hear from Martin, let's hear a continuation of the little spat there between the Leader of the Opposition, Ed Miliband, and Prime Minister David Cameron.
There are more women in work in our country than ever before in our history. We've seen a tax cut for 12 million women, a pension increase that is benefiting women, tax-free childcare that will help women who want to go out to work, more support on childcare. Now, he talks about MPs and candidates. He might enjoy this one. The candidate for Withenshaw, the Labour candidate for Withenshaw, has made an endorsement today. He has endorsed Miliband. David Miliband.
Hey, Mr. Speaker, if I were him, I would not be talking about candidates this week of all weeks. Because what is the Tory party doing? Removing one of their most senior women and seeking to replace her with an old Etonian. It says it all about the Conservative Party. And he didn't answer the question. I'll tell him why the gender pay gap is increasing. Because the minimum wage has been losing value. Because the growth of zero-hours contracts and the problem women have accessing childcare. He promised to modernise his party, but he's going backwards. He runs his government like the old boys' network. That's why he's failing women across his party and across the country.
Isn't it interesting that with six questions and an invitation to condemn the strike today, not a word? Isn't that the truth? He raises constituency selections in a week when he's completely rolled over to the trade unions.
Well, I mean, Cameron there, the Prime Minister, trying to raise the issue of tube strikes, not really answering the question, Martin. This business, though, of Eton, the Bullingdon Club, these points do actually go home. Ed Miliband seems to be finding his feet a little bit this week.
Well, I think from the sort of backroom strategist point of view, what's becoming clear is there is a gender gap opening up in opinion polls on intentions to vote, and in the swing constituencies around London, which are going to decide the next election, there's clearly more tendency for women to want to vote Labour and men to vote Tory. Now, in other words, there must be breakfast tables in those constituencies in which the women have made up their mind to go with Labour and the chap hasn't. And of course, those rows over the breakfast table will determine which way the election goes. And I think that from the Conservatives' point of view, I mean, everybody's in favour of more women in politics. I'd hardly dare mention here we are in the locker room, boys, but there's no women in here with us at the moment, is there? I think it's interesting. And that's probably why Miliband has gone for this particular target at this particular time.
What about Ed's point there about the old boy network? Does sound a bit nasty, doesn't it, Mark?
It does. I mean, he's making the same point on and off. It's sort of like a stuck record. David Cameron is a millionaire, and yes, Ed Miliband is as well. In fact, as far as I'm aware, quite a few members of the shadow cabinet are.
75% of British MPs. 75% of British MPs are millionaires.
Really?
Yes.
See,
it's more than the US Congress.
I do think that smacks a little hypocritical. It's sort of, you're arguing who's more privileged than who.
Okay.
And actually, a whole raft of them are equally privileged.
Okay, on to another question. And this one is Fiona McTaggart asking about fraud at the job centres.
Taggart. On the 22nd of February 2012, I asked the Prime Minister about fraud at A4E, a company working with job seekers. He told me he was waiting for the truth before he would act. This week's guilty pleas by A4E staff reveal a culture of fraud in that company. Isn't the list of taxpayer-funded fraudsters, Serco, G4S, A4E, getting too long? When's it going to stop?
I think the Honourable Lady makes an important point, but the answer I would give is, instead of bandying around names of companies where many people in those companies will be working hard to do a good job, what we should do is investigate wrongdoing properly and make sure that cases are properly taken to court, as in this case it clearly was.
Mark Weston, Deputy Leader of the Conservatives on Bristol City Council. You're getting a few jabs there from Fiona McTaggart, talking about taxpayer-funded privatised industries. She hasn't even mentioned the taxpayer-funded banks, which have been committing fraud in things like foreign exchange, LIBOR, this kind of thing.
We've had this discussion before. My view is actually incredibly simple. If they've committed fraud, they should be investigated, they should go to court, and if found guilty, they should go to jail. It is as simple as that in my mind, and it doesn't matter to me whether you're doing fraud in a job centre or you're doing fraud on trading floor. Fraud is fraud, and it should all be investigated, and they should go to jail. I think businesses can help the government, and they can help in certain roles, and they can assist. But if they start to take the Michael, as it were, then I'm sorry, they need to be investigated, and anyone that's found guilty should go to jail.
Well, the evidence here is that by opening up the job centre facilities to competition, to private businesses, they've also opened them up to fraud.
Yes, but at the same time, you know, I sit on the audit committee, and there is the possibility of fraud within levels of government as well. The fraud can happen at any time. There seem to be numerous cases where it's happening in the private sector, but there are numerous cases where it happens in the public sector as well. Fraud is fraud. It's very simple. You investigate it, you take them to court. If they're found guilty, they go to jail.
Well, City of London Police don't seem to agree with you, because they do virtually zero prosecutions up in the City of London.
And they need kicking to do it.
I think that's a criminal offence, kicking, isn't it? Martin.
What kind of verbal kicking? All right. Friend.
Martin.
I think I agree with what's just been said, but I think the problem is that the level of fraud and criminality that is now at the top of our society has become so endemic that it's very difficult to know where
to
start.
But this isn't necessarily at the top. This is the job centres, Martin.
You mentioned the banks and the LIBOR fraud and so on as well, but I mean, what we're dealing with here is a culture of criminality and a culture also of entitlement.
I think we have a real problem, and it's actually on both sides of the Atlantic, and it's on both sides of the Channel. It's, we seem to have this view that white collar crime, I think, use the American term that they've used on it. You get a slap on the wrist, and it seems to be viewed very differently.
Well, a bit of a fine,
fraud.
And then what happens, you know, is your share price goes up because the investors have been thinking it might be a bigger fine.
Fraud, I'm sorry, wrecks lives.
It wrecks the economy ultimately as well. I mean, Peter Galbraith, who's the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous US economist, he's pushing very hard in the US, saying we're never going to solve this problem until some of the senior people go to prison. And that, but the problem we've got, HSBC, I think we mentioned when you were last on here, they were convicted of money laundering for the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico, and they got a slap on the wrist fine.
Yeah.
And that's problem is since the Enron era, the problem is that it's become systematic. Enron accounting has become the norm, and what's happened is that when one big organisation gets away with it, say Goldman Sachs, if the other organisations don't copy their business method, they will go down.
Okay, guys, before we get off the subject of white collar crime, the Royal Mail share flotation.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Royal Mail shares are currently trading at 587 pence, almost 80% higher than when the government sold off its share. Does the Prime Minister still honestly believe that his government properly valued Royal Mail, and that the price was set at the best deal to get the best deal for the taxpayer?
I think the government did a good job to get private sector capital into Royal Mail, something which frankly has evaded governments of all colours and all persuasions for decades. And I well remember sitting on that side of the House and hearing about the appalling losses in Royal Mail, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of pounds. And I think the fact that it is now well managed, well run, with private sector capital in it, is a very great development for our country.
Well, that's a not cold comfort there, really, Martin, isn't it? Because we're talking about nearly doubling the actual value. So the taxpayer was shortchanged massively, around about £1 billion in the sell-off of Royal Mail.
Yeah, well, the Goldman Sachs were involved in this business, and they were telling the people, the insiders, to buy at the price that they recommended to the government, because they knew it was going to go up. They said, you're going to make a killing here. Now, in actual fact, we're talking about austerity in this country. We've just wasted £2 billion there. We've given a free handout, £2 billion, to those who participated in the share sale, and of course, many of them will be swing voters in Tory constituencies. So they've got a nice free handout, but it's actually the people's money. Of course, course it is.
Now, every single person in the country has suffered, lost £55 over this.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure I fully buy that. I think the problem with Royal Mail is, because it's an unknown quantity, I mean, obviously Lloyds is going to at some point get its share sell-off, but it's a known quantity. People know all about Lloyds.
Well, maybe.
We hope. But they don't quite know how the Royal Mail can work. So I do still think there's a hell of a lot of froth there. And I'm not going to say that whether we ripped off or not till I've seen it settle down after a year, and we're not there yet.
Can I say who does think it's been a rip off, and that's Stephen Lansdowne of Lansdowne Hargreaves. I don't normally agree with him about anything, but
he said, see, I agreed with you earlier on something which I don't normally do. You agreed with Stephen.
He said this, the
government have miffed it basically. They've mispriced it.
I mean, they might well have done. Certainly the shares rose. I say I'm going to give it more time, because if they'd sold it and the shares hadn't moved, then people would have been complaining about how maybe they were priced too high. I'm going to wait and see what it's down after the year.
Well, the Conservatives have played a blinder, it seems to me, because they've shovelled all the blame onto the Lib Dems and Vince Cable. Anyway, next story. A&E,
price it, in fairness.
A&E departments under pressure from malnourished patients, claims Labour. This is Richard Wheeler in The Independent. A&E departments are under increasing pressure from a rising number of malnourished people, Labour claims. Speaking in the House of Commons, Shadow Health Secretary Andy Burnham made a link between the economic climate and a rise in diseases connected with not eating property, including scurvy, rickets, the use of food banks and hypothermia. Mr. Burnham also insisted too many older people are sent to hospitals because they are unable to get the right support in their homes. Introducing the Opposition Day debate on the NHS, former Health Secretary Mr. Burnham also said attendances to accident and emergency increased by a staggering 633,000 between 2010 and 2013 after the coalition, and questioned what is happening. Mark.
See, it's interesting. I've read the same article as you, but a lot of it actually, it seems to be anecdotal in what he's saying. Now, obviously, the number of people going to A&E has increased. I don't think anyone's going to doubt that. But actually, if you look at the way he phrased his question, and politicians choose these phrases very, very carefully, speak to A&E staff. He didn't provide data. He provided an anecdote. And even The Independent, which is obviously it's a little left-leaning on that, it uses throughout its piece claimed. So it's not totally sure either. Now, if it is that people are going there malnourished, then that's a tragedy and people should look at that. But actually, there's no, if you pardon the expression, storm of malnourishment, there's no meat to this. There's no statistic that goes with it. He is making an unsubstantiated claim. I'd rather have a serious debate. If it is, then let's get the data and look at it. But he hasn't provided that. He's just made an assertion.
Martin?
Yeah, he's mentioned scurvy here. 12 and 18 people, is it something? 18 people in 2013. There are some figures behind it, but I mean, basically...
But 18 for scurvy in 12-13.
So, no, it's not...
I don't know what the benchmark for that was.
No, I don't know.
Prior to that.
No, I mean, the fact is that we know A&E departments are under pressure, and I think one of the problems is that people find it very difficult to get doctor's appointments. And they're going to A&E as a result of that.
I'd agree.
And I think what Labour are articulating, perhaps not terribly coherently, there is that people are hurting at the bottom of our society. I think that's absolutely clear.
Well, can I just give the figures? I mean, what he's saying basically is that the figures for scurvy people admitted in 2011 to 2012 was 8 people, and the next year, which is 2012 to 2013, it's 18 people. So
the issue on that,
that's going up about 2.5 times. Isn't it?
Well, it is. Well,
and it's only a very small sample. But scurvy, I mean, surely scurvy is something that was wiped out decades ago.
Well, apparently not, because there were at least 8 people in 2011-12. It is a small sample. I simply don't know whether that's a blip or not. Maybe we need the medical data to actually look at that. But, I mean, he does go on. He does give a sum. Malnutrition has doubled in terms of the number of hospital admittances, 8-9, where... near double from 3,161 to 5,499. Small numbers, but personal tragedy to each and every one of those cases. I'd love to know why that is. Is that because of the doctor? Is it a case of because, for example, a care home isn't providing proper care to them? There are probably a lot of underlying issues that we should look at.
I mean, there's no denying the problems in an accident and emergency. Surely, Mark.
No. But what I'm trying to say is he made a lot of assertions in his speech. We didn't actually give a great deal.
I mean, we're supposed to, the Conservatives are supposed to be holding the NHS as safe in their hands. I mean, what's happening is more and more people are going to the last resort, which is accident and emergency. Queues are enormous. And also there's long waiting times for ambulances so that they can't actually discharge their patients either.
Not being funny on that. And you see, I do have an issue because I've had experience, personal experience, someone very close to me had a brain scan, and this was under the last Labour government, and we waited 22 months to get the result. Now, when that was finally looked at by a specialist, he went, "This is useless to me. You should have been here 8 months." In 8 months. So, I hate to be the one, 'twas ever thus. The NHS does need changes. It does need reform. But it needs to be rational reform. And I actually think the people at the top of the NHS are stopping any form of reform at all. It seems to be a case of we need to be able to go on business as usual. Patients come first.
OK, Martin, reform or business as usual at the NHS?
I don't think the NHS needs reform. I mean, in actual fact, the pitch by the Prime Minister to the electorate at the last election is we are not going to touch this at all. That's what he said. And in actual fact, there's an old adage, a conservative adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
It's a good one, actually.
It is a good one. And the NHS has been there were lots of idiotic marketised reforms from during the New Labour era. And of course, we're still talking this kind of management school jargonese nonsense, so it's still dinning around in our heads.
Okay, that's it for that discussion. Sorry, we've got to move on. We haven't got much time, just 2 minutes. UKIP chairman has advocated, you'll love this one, Mark. UKIP chairman has advocated termination of Down syndrome fetuses and breaking from the UK by force, claims a Tory MP. This is again the Independent. An outgoing UKIP chairman in personal correspondence advocated the termination of fetuses with Down syndrome and also that the UK should break from the EU by force of arms if necessary. He's now resigned from the party after being thanked for his contribution. What do you make of this? Is the chairman of the UK Independence Party
bonkers? What do you expect me to make of it? It is ridiculous. And I'm sorry. I think this is one of those things we've been talking about. UKIP is rising in the polls. UKIP is getting greater scrutiny, and I'm afraid they have a few people that are just crazy.
Okay.
This is not. I'm trying to choose my language carefully here, because you see, I have a lot of respect for, UKIP voters. I think they're passionate people and they're not feeling listened to. But people at the top of UKIP, I do think.
But you know what? They're going to get loads of votes more than you are at these Euro elections because they have sorted out the European issue. The Conservative Party is still wrangling with it after 20 years. It still hasn't decided what it's doing.
Well, I actually think we do have a coherent European policy. I mean, it's very easy for UKIP to sell a message because theirs is a case of out at all costs. Ours is a case of we're going to try reform and then put it to you in a referendum. Now, I would much rather try reform and then if it fails, we leave. That's my personal view. But they're a lot of UKIP are sort of saying, well, we don't really want the referendum on it, we just want to leave. Well, in order to make that kind of size constitutional change, the people should have a say. This force of arms argument is just...
Martin, this chap's diary included a statement, if there is to be a bloodletting in this country, there are a lot of people who would be candidates for my supply of piano wire. The comments referred to a possible civil war over the European Union. Piano wire has been used as a silent garrote to kill people since World War II.
Well, they are coming under scrutiny, as Mark says. I think, in actual fact, they are not going to do as well as people imagine. And of course, when we come to a first past the post election, a British election under our marvellous old constitution, they are going to be wiped out.
Well, time now for the Murdoch news at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest, deputy leader of the Bristol City Council's Conservative Group, and councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston. After the Murdoch news, US State Department official Victoria Nuland. Interesting conversation. Tapped on her phone.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, David Cameron says he'll make sure lessons are learned from the way severe flooding in Somerset's been handled. He's made an impromptu visit to the county hours after the Environment Agency's chairman did the same. Lord Smith's been confronted by angry residents...